Well, I mean, let's be absolutely clear about Tony Blair. The man is a consummate liar. I don't think there's anybody really that takes him seriously and believes him. And it's quite frightening to think that, you know, he was being put forward as the president of Europe, someone who is known by most people across the globe as a barefaced liar. You know, we're in a situation now where some of the most hideous characters in the country are being put forward as our leaders, and you wonder how this situation has come to pass. But as for his motives, I think it's pretty clear. He wants nice jobs in easy, cosy, corporate, massive amounts of pay, directorships, when he's finished, in quite possibly the arms industry. And let's look at one of these massive arms investment groups like the Carlyle Group. What did John Major, the previous Prime Minister, do when he left office? He went in to become, almost immediately, a director of the Carlyle Investment Group. So you can see, all the time he was Prime Minister, you have to wonder, did he really give a fig for the people of Britain? Or was he just on his little conveyor belt and promises, you know, made in smoky rooms before he was a Prime Minister, that there was going to be a nice job for him if he towed the line? I think we're in a situation now where anybody who's in a political office in Britain, and let's face it, anywhere in the world, really has to prove their credentials as a man or a woman of the people before they go into these positions. Otherwise, certainly sceptical people like me, and I can tell you many of the public as well, will assume that they are going into these jobs for their own ends. Now, another thing is that there is some evidence out there that Tony Blair is a Rosicrucian. Now, this is a particular brand of Freemasonry, which is a kind of Christian angle to it. But the Rosicrucians, I mean, Blair's Lodge apparently is a Studholme Alliance Lodge, which is based in Duke Street in London, and any Masonic buffs can see that this place is called the Supreme Council. I mean, these people are a secret society, basically, but they have very grand titles. Mm. And so you have to wonder, what is Blair's loyalty? Is it to a financial oligarchy, an elite, or is he in any way interested in the people? And I was quite disgusted to see him at the Chilcot inquiry last week trying to wriggle out of some of the most important questions to do with the deaths of something like 500,000 people, the bunch of more who would have had to move through forced migration. And he's just able to sort of answer it in this slippery way without the main evidence being put against him. And I wonder if in the Nuremberg trials in 1945, after the end of the Second World War, if the Nazi generals and the Nazi commanders had been given such an easy ride as Tony Blair was at the Chilcot inquiry. It seems that these kind of things have been almost perfected to allow the guilty people to get off and to present it as a kind of press conference rather than a proper trial. And of course, in that sort of situation, justice is not done, and the entire country suffers as a result.
Just going back a little bit, Tony, going back to Tony Blair again, and going back to Iran. I know we're the UK and the US actually hell-bent on going to Iran. Now, I mean, you did talk about some of the motives, but do you reckon the other motive could be to protect Israel?
Well, partly, but I think obviously Iran is sitting on massive oil resources too. That is one of the reasons it seems now that we're looking at the fuel prices going up to 135 a litre. I nearly said a gallon there. Well, 135 a litre. And, you know, the obvious side of sort of psychological thing about this is, well, you know, maybe we need to get hold of some more oil. That's one motive. Another motive is that the Iranian government, the Iranian people, is very much independent from the United States and from many other parts of the Western world in their views, in their values. They have much more traditional values, and the so-called liberal progressive values there are in the West haven't made much of an impact in Iran. So this is another reason why the Iranians are a target. I think the fact that they are trying to get a nuclear fuel and nuclear power program going is just simply, I mean, which is absolutely fine under the Non-Proliferation Treaty, absolutely fine, which, by the way, the Israelis have not signed up to. So the Iranians have signed up to this, but not the Israelis, and the Israelis, it seems, are not even criticised for failing to sign up to the treaty which nuclear power is within for Iran. So I think there are all sorts of other reasons, real reasons, why Iran is a target, and the least of those is nuclear energy. Actually, what the real reason is because certain people around the world don't like the fact that Iran is a traditional independent country. In fact, its culture goes back thousands of years, and this is something which certain factions in the West, the businessmen, the business factions, really despise the fact that these people have their own values, their own ideas, and actually their own morals, their own laws, that aren't changeable by a Western system and by Western governments. So they want to have a kind of regime change so they can start telling the Iranian people what the difference between right and wrong is. And I think it's been pretty much clear by looking at the Western values over the last 10 years, at the very least, probably before that, that the West has got it wrong. So it's got absolutely no right to impose anything on Iran. And I wish the Iranians well, and I also would like to note that the best speech last year in the United Nations to do with world unity and world peace was made by the Iranian president, and the British and many other Western delegates had a pre-arranged walkout, which is just appalling. They're not interested in peace. The Western capitalists seem to just thrive on war, and they not only do they thrive on it, they make lots of money at it. And in a recession, it seems that there's a real battle now for trying to get profits, and the war companies, the various arms producers, which is an area which the Carlyle Group I was talking about earlier on, investment people, they invested massively, and John Major and his friends, previous prime ministers, they are the ones who are going to benefit from this. The people of the West and the people of the Middle East are the ones who are going to have to suffer if there is any kind of war. And I think Tony Blair has got a real cheek after making it absolutely clear that he lied in order to get one war going. He's now going to try and do the same again. This is all incredibly depressing. And the idea that he is given credibility by broadcasters and is not taken apart by journalists, I find rather disappointing too.
Tony, if I could jump in. You mentioned Iran. Do you think we'll have another situation in 2003 when we do go into war with Iran, regardless everyone's against the United Nations, the public? Do you think David Cameron might just say to Obama, to the United States, let's go attack Iran? Do you think it will happen?
Well, I honestly don't know. I mean, it's been 3 years or 4 years now that there have been constant threats against Iran. The one country that doesn't seem to get talked about so much is Pakistan, and I think what's happened there is there is a war being waged by the West against Pakistan. There's many Western troops are in Pakistan. There's all sorts of collusion between corrupt Pakistani officials, particularly in the ISI, the security service in Pakistan, and the West. And I think it's pretty clear to me that there is right now a covert, a secret war being waged against Pakistan. So, you know, there's also, of course, a secret war being waged against Iran. We've had several incidents now of top Iranian people, professors, particularly connected with the nuclear program, simply being blown up within Iran. So that it's clear that there are Western agents of some sort operating, assassinating people within Iran. Now, of course, this is designed to get the Iranians to hate the West. But they're very sensible, and I think a very, very mature leadership in Iran. I mean, let's just look at the incident where there were a bunch of captured British Navy people. What they did is they were looked after, they were mildly interrogated, asked a few questions, and then they were just simply released. And I think this has a very powerful effect on the British people. We're seeing one thing from our leaders who are telling us these Iranians are very, very dangerous and evil and trying to make nuclear bombs. And on the other hand, we can see by the actions of the Iranian leadership that they're actually very sensible, kind, loving, and moderate. So that starts to open up questions in the minds of people in Britain about what is going on with our leadership, and maybe we should put our own house in order before we start threatening to declare war on a sovereign country.
No, I think to move away onto perhaps, you know, our preliminary topic before we end the show, because we've got a little sports section towards the end as well. A favourite topic since the 80s, really, is privatisation. From the period of Thatcher, where many things were indeed privatised, to the times that we're living now, of course, where, you know, 3 decades down the line, we're looking at a very, very different picture. And once again, with Tony as our guest, we'd like to get your words on privatisation.
Well, yeah, I think one of the things, obviously, we've heard the last week or so is about the National Health Service, and we're being told it's not being privatised, they're just opening it up. Now, I think, for me, one of the most fascinating comparisons is look at what's happened to the Royal Mail and look at what they're doing to the NHS. It seems to me that there's no imagination here whatever, and exactly what is happening to the National Health Service now is what happened several years ago to the Royal Mail. What they said at the time, we're not privatising Royal Mail, we're just opening it to competition. And what happened was that all of the lucrative parts of the Royal Mail service, that is to say, for example, your bank is sending out statements and it's sending out, 100,000 bank statements to various customers, that is considered to be half of what the mail does. So one lorry load carrying all these letters from the bank to the Royal Mail sorting office is considered a very lucrative contract, because you're getting paid a little bit for each of those letters, and you only have to employ one lorry driver and one lorry to do the job. They get paid massive amounts of money, these private contractors in the Royal Mail, to do very, very simple, small jobs. And then, of course, once all those letters arrive at the sorting office, it's the Royal Mail's job to sort them all out and deliver them all over the country. And so what's happening is that these contractors are getting paid way over the odds. And as a result, they are like leeches within the Royal Mail system, the private businesses. And, of course, looking at the National Health Services, this is like going back to several hundred years to the leeches back then, is that the private businesses that are going to be instituted within the National Health Service to provide care are going to be going for all of the most lucrative areas of the National Health Service and making money out of them. And if we go back to the Royal Mail, we're now in the situation where the Royal Mail is in such a dire straits because it's been sucked dry by these private businesses of any of its profits that it's been making, and brought to its knees by these private companies taking all the easy things for the Royal Mail to do. A similar thing, I mean, they're now talking about just simply privatising the whole thing of Royal Mail, selling it off to anybody, to someone from Singapore, anybody that wants to come and buy the Royal Mail can do so. And this worries me, that now they've started down this road of semi-privatisation of the health service. Yeah. In a couple of years' time, they're going to say, oh, well, we're very sorry, but the health service can't do it anymore. So it's just going to simply sold off. And we'll have no health service at that point. The only people that will get treated are the people with money. And, you know, we didn't fight the Second World War to institute a social security system in this country, to have it then just sold off and taken away. And so I think that basically the private businesses that fund the Conservative Party and to a lesser extent the Liberal Democrat Party, it seems, are just literally calling the shots. They're saying, look, we can see something lucrative here, we can get a monopoly on it, we can make loads of money at it, can you please close down your public services so that we can do it instead? And David Cameron and George Osborne and his friends are just saying, yeah, fine. And Andrew Lansley, the Health Secretary, absolutely fine, just do it. And of course, they're acting in their own interests, they're acting in the interests of big business, private capital, the plutocracy, and not in the interests of Britain. And all they do when they spin one of these things, like the National Health Service part privatisation, is they pick two or three reasons why it might be plausible to do this, and just roll them out again and again and again and hope that people will believe them. But I'm hoping and I'm thinking that the British public are getting rather fed up with this and getting wise to their silly little game. And it's not only if it wasn't a matter of life and death, it would be a silly game.
Well, I think something as serious as the NHS, it cannot be taken lightly by the public.
No. Yeah, but it's being taken lightly by the government. This is the thing that scares me. And I don't think they're making themselves any friends, but it seems to me that many politicians now I've lost interest in doing the right thing. It's just the least of the worst things that they do.
That's it's probably the most frightening thing we've discussed in this show today in terms of, you know, us here living in the UK ourselves, of course. I mean, the NHS is an institution that we've known since birth, most of us. Well, of course. You know, yeah. You simply go into a hospital, you're treated.
Well, what I find interesting, though, guys, here's America, installing a health service similar to ours.
Well, the healthcare reforms, yeah.
Oh, yeah, and we trying to actually sell ours and make it privatized. And if that was to happen, it would be, a black day for the UK, for Britain itself.
Yeah, but I think the trouble is that the private interests and, with the bankers in their situation as they are, with their millions of bonuses and these politicians that we elect shrugging their shoulders and say, sorry, we can't do anything. Well, of course they can. They choose not to do anything. That what we really need is some proper leadership, and that can only come, I think, when we've got our media opened up, which brings us almost roundabout back down to talking about censorship again, and the way that the London-based press, the newspapers, the broadcasters and the radio limit the debate and limit the discussion about the possible futures, and they seem to be stuck in this really outdated idea that our current political system is working, because I've got news for them. Most British people don't think it's working. They don't think that the democracy is healthy, and many of them have just simply stopped voting.
And that's the last thing you want, really, is apathy. But as I've heard recently in certain radio shows and podcasts, there's an example that's been put around, basically. And the example it goes like this, basically. Apparently, there was an experiment carried out. And this experiment, it involved dogs, basically. What would happen is that there were two groups of dogs. And the first group of dogs would be electrocuted. And there was a fence. Now, if these dogs were to jump over the fence, they could escape from being electrocuted. There was a second group of dogs who were continuously electrocuted. It didn't matter whether they were jumped over the fence or whether they stayed where they were just electrocuted over and over and over again. So the second group of dogs gave up. They just didn't bother trying to jump over the fence. Mm-hmm. But the first group of dogs, they realized that by jumping over the fence, they could be saved. So it's sort of what this implies is, like society today, that many people have become completely and utterly apathetic and fed up with the system. Like someone said earlier, I don't know if it was Tony, whether it was Steve, but someone said that it doesn't seem to make a difference anymore. You vote in one political party, you vote in the next political party. No change happens whatsoever. If anything, things just get worse. And many people probably feel like burying their heads in the sand, and that's a very, very worrying
thing. Well, the other reaction, of course, is that people get angry. This is sometimes spills out onto the streets. What makes people even more angry is when the police then overstep their powers and charge into demonstrations, start attacking people who haven't done anything at those demonstrations. And this sort of cycle of violence is, I think, something we've got to be very, very wary of in the months to come, because it looks like we're going to have industrial action, big demonstrations against the cuts in the spring, certainly possibly before that. I think one of the things is really important to get across is that we want these demonstrations to be legally policed, not policed by thuggery from the police or from demonstrators. And of course, one of the things that the police has been shown do now is they actually do put agent provocateurs in amongst the demonstrators sometimes. It may not even necessarily be the police. They may be being employed by a private company to be an agent provocateur in a demonstration. The idea being to try and discredit the entire demonstration and to stall what would be a natural public protest and the peaceful right to protest, and to get rid of that and to discredit it. So there are all sorts of sharks out there trying to make sure the people don't get their way, even if they go out onto the streets and beg for justice.
What we're going to do now, we're going to wind things down for the last 10 minutes or so, and after all that doom-laden, if you like, news.
Well, I would just like to say one positive, if that's all right. Say something positive about all this, and that is that the excesses of David Cameron. I mean, we had the resignation of his Andy Coulson, his communications director, who was already, right from the word go, before the general election, he's had his head on the chopping block, and he's now at last decided that he can't do it anymore. What we've had with the press and with Cameron and his Bullingdon Club chums and his Eton mates, the Oxford lot and the Eton lot, what's happening is it's actually bringing people together right across the country. A lot of people are now getting politicised, sitting in the pubs talking about stuff. Did you see the students discussing things? And actually, this is great for the country. You know, as people start chatting through these issues and start talking to people, sometimes even chatting to strangers and people chipping in from the other side of the room saying, hang on a minute, I don't agree with that. What's happening is a new political movement is building to actually enforce democracy, because people naturally want justice, and there's a natural thing in everybody where they will make sure that justice is done, but only if they're brought together. And it looks like Cameron and his excesses are actually doing that right across the land.
Well, I'd say that's a very positive thing. To wind up, we're going to go to the sports section. We've got Tony here, and something we don't often talk about is women's football.
Well, no, that's right. We were talking about football last week quite a bit. But it's just something that annoys me is the way that women's football is shut off of television.
Yes.
I can remember, this is a few years ago, covering a story when I was in London, about one of the biggest women's leagues in the country had actually negotiated with the Wembley Stadium to use Wembley for their Women's League Cup final at some sort of cup price rate. And what was happening was that there was actually loads and loads and loads of tickets were going for this final from right across the country. Obviously, you know, people connected with these women's teams, the families of people, and the idea that they would actually be playing at Wembley was really taking off. Anyway, Wembley decided to change their mind. No, you can't do it. We've changed their mind. You're not going to be able to use Wembley. What on earth was that all about? What they're trying to do, I think, the authorities at Wembley and elsewhere and in men's football, the FA, is trying to actually stop women's football being seen on TV like anything else. I mean, I don't think mixed teams make much sense, but simple different physical characteristics between men and women. And also, women have a different style of playing. You know, it's a kind of, you know, I actually really enjoy watching women's football in some ways more than men's, because it's less aggressive, it needs to be more thoughtful. And I'd like to see women's style football televised regularly. Certainly, as you know, maybe not absolutely as many as football matches on men's matches, but there has been a deliberate attempt to make out that women's football doesn't exist. And this is absolutely outrageous. This is one of the big scandals. Never mind this thing we've heard about these commentators making sexist comments. The big scandal is women's football is being censored.
No, I mean, women's football is quite... I've seen a couple of matches, Birmingham, Aston Villa women, first of all, and then I've seen Birmingham City. I haven't seen some of the Arsenal women actually play, and they are actually, they do actually play a lot more better football in some cases.
Yeah, so we have to ask ourselves, why do we never see this women's football on the TV? But, you know, this is the way most people actually would, you know, probably prefer to watch football, is on the TV in the evening, rather than trekking across country to watch a match, you know, actually in person. You have to be quite a big fan to do that. But we simply don't see it on the TV. I mean, it may be that there are some sort of pay channels that have a little bit on that I've not seen, but it seems to me pretty clear that women's football is being spent by the men, I would imagine, men at Sky, men at the BBC and elsewhere, and also people who run the industry are almost all men. And maybe the women would put the men to shame, and they're a bit embarrassed about them.
Why not indeed?
I mean, women's football in America is pretty big. They did have a David Beckham version of a footballer they call Mia Hamm. Have you heard of a Mia Hamm?
Never, no.
No, she's she's married to a baseball star, Alex Rodriguez.
Yes.
They're A-Rod, they call him. And they're like the Becks and Posh and Becks.
Of the women's team.
Sorry. So, yeah, women's football is pretty big in America. And we do have a few female footballers, English footballers.
I have to say, guys, Humay and Tarek and Tony, I think, though the women's football is being censored a lot by the main industry, the professional leagues and whatever, it is over the last couple of years, or over the last few years, it has actually taken off quite a bit. I mean, for example, the Women's FA Cup final, I mean, the BBC, actually, Radio 5, anyway, give it quite a bit of coverage.
It's got to go on the telly, you know. It's all very well, you know, in the old days, listening to the football on the radio, but you've got to actually, I mean, surely in order to experience the game, you've got to be able to actually see it.
Of course.
Rather than just listen to it talked about second hand. And there is, I mean, I haven't seen any women's football on TV. Let's just stick it on the telly and see what the ratings are. You know, this is the arrogance, I'm afraid, of the TV managers. It seems that they have decided already that we're not going to be interested in it. They haven't even given us a chance to see it.
Well,
I wonder how many other sports would do really well on television. I mean, there's hundreds of sports out there that we know.
Well, I mean, we've got to look at women's tennis. I mean, for example, tennis. I mean that is really, really popular. I mean, when you got people, you're like Martina Hingis, the Williams sisters.
Yeah, so I was about to mention those two.
I think the women's tennis is seen as less competitive as the men's.
Yes.
I think the top two men's are Nadal and Federer, whereas the women's you got the Serena and Venus Williams.
The
Williams
sisters, yep.
Yeah. So I can see why tennis, the female tennis, is less popular than men because the competitive edge is not really there.
But the thing is, you can still watch it. That's the thing. They've been given a chance. And to be honest, like, these people are hugely, you know, renowned and famous sports personalities.
Yeah.
Well, they are.
Yeah, so I mean, let's have the women's football on the television. Let's have it on every week.
I agree with that.
And let's have the final at Wembley.
Yeah, and why not? Yeah. Well, why should we be misogynistic?
We'll have to have a female version of Gary Lineker presenting it.
I think we should start a petition, you know?
I agree.